SBS Audio is supported by advertising.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Death and technology intersect in really different ways. It's almost on two axes. You've got death positive or death denial, right? You've got people who are using technology to try and build better deaths and end-of-life experiences for people. And then you've got people who are using technology to try and deny death or fight death or beat death.
Welcome to Grave Matters, a lively look at death.
All of us at Grave Matters would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land we are recording from. We pay our respects to the Cammeraygal people and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge the traditional owners from all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander lands you are listening from. A warning, this episode contains references to death and other themes related to dying. Please take care. Anthony Levin, hello.
Hi, Nadine Jonas Brothers Cohen.
Amazing.
Nadine, you worked at Google before it was cool, so I'm guessing you like technology.
I would say I worked at Google when it was cool.
Oh, touche.
And yes, I do.
Because today we're going to be talking about technology and death, and we'll be joined by Doyen of Death Tech, Dr. Hannah Gould. But first, can you and I do a little hypothetical?
Sure.
Okay, so let's say your cat Blanche Devereaux died tomorrow. Like, you wake up and she's on the
Please
floor.
Please don't do this to me.
Rigor mortis.
She's never going to die.
She's never dying. But setting aside your immobilizing grief, could you replace her with a robo-cat?
I'm going to need a little bit more information.
So instead of going to the pet store or a pound and or a special place that has cats that are sourced ethically, you go to RoboCat Land and you get a robot cat, and it's the replacement Blanche. It's Blanche Devereaux.
Is it furry?
It can be, yes.
Does it purr?
It purrs. It scratches people's bags. Not that that happened to me.
Will it hurt if I sleep spooning it?
Yes.
No, then.
All the things that Blanche would do, it does.
Fair.
No, you wouldn't.
No.
Why not?
I don't want to get hurt while I spoon my robo-cat.
Okay, take the hurt out.
Yes, sure. Give me a robo-cat.
There's no right answer here, but I guess...
Blanche Devereaux robot.
Well done.
Thank you.
I'm not the only one that makes the dad jokes.
Usually you are.
Usually I am. I guess the point here is we're going to explore some of these themes in today's episode. For as long as humans have tried to exert control over where, when, and how we die, technology has played some part in death culture. But how are 21st century technologies like AI and chatbots disrupting the way we remember the dead? How we plan funerals? How we care for the dying? Our next guest has all the answers. Dr. Hannah Gould is a cultural anthropologist. She has a PhD in anthropology from the University of Melbourne and a Master of Science from Oxford University. Yeah, she's a bit smart. She also holds a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Melbourne, where she's a member of the Death Tech Research Team, which studies death, technology, and society. And she's currently the president of the Australian Death Studies Society. Hannah Gould, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
So you call yourself a cultural anthropologist?
Yes.
Can you start by finishing this sentence for our listeners? Cultural anthropology is?
Cultural anthropology is the attempt to see the world from another person's point of view, and through doing so to reflect critically on your own position in the world. Hmm. So we often talk about the familiar strange in anthropology. So anthropology is the attempt to make that which first might seem super weird or odd or strange, to make it familiar, to understand the logic of it, to understand why people do it and what it means to them. And then through doing that, in the reverse, to make that which we seem familiar, normal, ordinary, taken for granted about our own experience, to make it seem strange to reflect critically on it and think, hey, it's really odd how we're doing this, and ask questions about it. And I suppose through that process, we can then maybe decide to change some of the things that we take for granted or do every day.
I find myself strangely fascinated by this making unfamiliar process. Maybe I'm not alone. Nadine is nodding.
Scribbling some notes about it right now.
Yeah. Does that mean I should have become a cultural anthropologist, or are we all just a little bit of that inside?
Well, I mean, I think everyone should become a cultural anthropologist.
Yes, you're a little biased. No,
I'm a little biased. No, but I think everyone can appreciate the tools of cultural anthropology, and I think they're probably lots of great writers and storytellers and thinkers who have a similar approach to the world.
Before we got too deep into the anthropological weeds on the links between death and technology, we wanted to know, what was it that led Hannah to study death in the first place?
I mean, I think there's, for me, there's like personal reasons and then there's academic reasons, and they're always overlap. Like, one was my dad died when I was 22, 23, around there. And it was one of those like 1% of the 1%. Like, he had a skin cancer that very rarely turns malignant, and it turned malignant. And then he, you know, was in a coma and then he got pneumonia. Like, it's this kind of story of everything kind of going wrong. And then there was just all these kind of questions that it brought up that surprised me. Questions about like what tombstone and what headstone, and all of the tombstones and the headstones and the caskets had these really weird names that were like, they were almost like paint colours, you know, like
Pantones.
Morning spring. And you're like, who?
Dishwashing detergent.
Exactly. Like, the kind of question I asked was like, well, who decided to name it that? Yeah. Right? So because I've always been interested in material culture and objects and things, it was like, who is the person that designed our death? Who is the person that designed this way of mourning for us? And at the same time, I was kind of struggling with that and these kind of questions. I was, you know, doing some work in Japan, and Japanese young people were also kind of struggling with their tradition of Buddhist ancestor worship, which seemed like to me to be an awesome system. I was like, why aren't we doing that? And they were saying, I don't like this. You know, I want to do something different. And so I kind of became interested in this kind of question of people who feel a disconnect with their systems of death and dying and how they negotiate that. And I suppose that led to the academic, which is like, anthropologists are so fascinated in human diversity, but then also in unity, right? Like, what brings us together as humanity? And then what are the differences? And death is the uber problem. Like, so much of humanity is our experience of mortality, which is one of the few things that we all do. Very few things that we all do. But we do it in such extraordinary different ways. You know, even if we think, oh, everyone cremates in the same way. No, they don't. Everyone buries in the same way. No, they don't. Like, there's so much diversity in how we respond to death that becomes this fascinating problem of like, what really sets us apart and what brings us together.
You are specifically interested in the area of death tech, which has always sounded to me like an episode of Black Mirror, but is actually short for death technology.
Yes.
What are some of the major trends in death tech right now?
So I suppose, I mean, technology can impact death all along the kind of timeline from the end of life through to memorialization. And I suppose at different stages in that long timeline, we have different kinds of intervention. So probably one of the major ones that we perhaps don't often think about as death tech is actually medical technology. So whether that be technologies for extending people's lives or technologies that actually rewrite what we think of as the line between life and death. So, you know, we often talk about, when we think about the history of death and dying, we talk about how, you know, that definition, that line changed from things like the last breath to when we were able to detect a heartbeat, then the last heartbeat, to this emerging idea of brain death and being in a coma. And what does it then mean if our lives are only sustained by machines, right? So there's this kind of rewriting of this idea. So medical technology is one huge area that, yes, it is in the health sphere, but also is fundamentally a death technology. Moving along then, I suppose, along that line, we have a lot of technologies and a lot of energy at the moment emerging around the idea of the handling and disposal of human remains. So globally, We have kind of what we call the big two, mm-hmm. Burial and cremation.
Mm-hmm.
And burial and cremation, you know, the majority of people worldwide use them, and for many hundreds of years they've been so super dominant in many different various forms and different expressions of those two technologies. But there are kind of this emerging area now of rival technologies, of new way of handling bodies, whether that be through something like alkaline hydrolysis, which is a kind of water acid-based technology for transforming bodies into bones.
Is that the same as aquamation?
That is the same as it's sometimes called aquamation or resomation. Or this is kind of an interesting conversation. I mean, there's lots of different branding kind of marketing moves around these technologies to try and work out how best to sell them to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And also things like human composting, recompose, those kind of areas. So there's also kind of technology, energies and innovation happening around the body. Mm-hmm. And then I suppose the third final major area of death and technology is around kind of commemorative spaces, particularly the use of online or AI or robotic tools to enliven the dead, to keep their memory alive, to allow them to communicate with the living, or simply to allow people to mourn and memorialise in ways that are more perhaps convenient for them, or they feel closer to the dead through doing so. So everything from, you know, Zoom use at funerals through to kind of holograms and AI and more experimental technologies. This is probably like looking at the broad landscape, they're probably the three main areas of technology as it intersects with death. But I mean, for me at least, technology is everything from a coffin through to a robot, right? Just because one is higher tech than the other, they're both technologies. So really it's fundamentally about the kind of material objects that we use to mediate or negotiate death.
And Hannah, how is the industry changing?
So the death care industry is an odd duck in many ways, particularly in Australia. There's lots of different parts of it, and not all of those parts necessarily talk to each other or necessarily see themselves as part of the same industry or sector. So when I talk about the death care sector, I'm really talking about everyone in that holistic view, everyone from kind of end of life workers through to commemoration and memorial.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
And a lot of them are really being challenged by new technological innovation. Some of that is to do with COVID and the changes they've had to make in response to social distancing restrictions. I mean, massive kind of requirements to upskill and become more high tech.
Mm-hmm.
And tech is obviously then leading to a number of disruptions in the sector as well. It's very easy for you now to, if you're a family, someone who's died, to jump on Google and look for a review of your funeral home, right? To compare different funeral homes. And that just wasn't something that happened for most of the history of the funeral sector. I mean, people went to the same funeral home that their family, that their community had always gone to. And, you know, it was all kind of word of mouth, which is not to say that word of mouth is still not important, but there are many ways then that their relationship with customers is being changed through technology, whether that's bringing an iPad to that initial meeting and filling out all the forms online, or people wanting PowerPoint slides and music and high tech, you know, lighting shows at the funeral. So it's a sector that's kind of in one way being, you know, challenged by all these emerging technologies. But then I think also is a sector that's fundamentally pretty resistant to change.
Mm-hmm.
Death tends to be quite conservative for a number of reasons. One of them is that usually for kind of most relatively privileged populations, at least, we tend to bury our elders.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're making decisions about funerals, it's not just what I would like, but what would grandma like, right? Mm-hmm. And so that can lead to conservatism. And then there's also the fact that most people in their lifetime, again, most people in a privileged position will only organise maybe one or two funerals. So it's not something that you really prepare for, and it's not something that you kind of repeat very frequently. And because of that, in this kind of time of immense, perhaps, emotional stress and kind of a ticking clock, you know, you've got to get this done, people tend to revert to more conservative choices in general. You know, we'll just do it how it's always been done. So because of that, I think even though the industry is being challenged and disrupted by all these new technologies in many ways, they're also pretty wary of them, and I think also have gotten by not responding You know, they've kind of been okay by being conservative and selling the standard model for a very long time.
Is this conservatism playing out in other cultures? We asked Hannah to talk about her time doing her PhD in Japan.
Why did I pick Japan? Well, it helped that I spoke Japanese. No, I mean, I began to be really interested in Japanese death ritual and death care for a number of reasons. I mean, one was that Japan is leading the world, I suppose, in a kind of negative way in a kind of aging population and questions around how the living might care not only for the elderly but also to care for the dead. Australia also has an aging population, and perhaps we will reach this kind of period slightly later. So I think they say now 2044 is the kind of era of a peak death for Australia, when our baby boomers age and reach average age of mortality.
Can you just explain that for our listeners? What do you mean by peak death?
Yes.
So, like the best death possible?
It's peak death, man.
Or death on mountains.
Yeah. So if we look at, you know, if you look at those kind of maps of the population, you look at the kind of, I suppose, waves of fertility that happen throughout generations. So we think classically of the baby boomer generation as this big generation. I think millennials have just overtaken them in the number of people. But that wave of fertility will eventually lead to a wave of mortality, as it were, because, you know, we have this kind of upper limit, as it were, or the, you know, at least an average of when most people die. And for baby boomers, you know, that's reaching around the 80s. Australia has quite a high average age of mortality. And because of that, we can then look at those demographics and think, okay, this super huge kind of population in our society will reach the average age of mortality around this year. And so what we're going to have at that time is more people dying than ever before. And so we have to think about how our death care systems are set up to deal with that kind of sudden peak death moment.
Is this the silver tsunami I have heard of in other conversations?
Yeah, it does connect to the silver tsunami.
Yep.
In the sense of this kind of aging population.
Yeah.
It also, interestingly enough, kind of affects what we might think of as the kind of timelines or the kind of pattern of our life and death. Mm-hmm. So not only do we have this kind of coming age of peak death in the future, but actually also because of how we're dying has changed, it kind of affects the last decades of our lives. So scholars in death studies will talk about the contemporary era as this era of prolonged dwindling, which is another interesting term. But basically, we used to have a lot more sudden deaths, right? And so you'd have, you know, sudden deaths in war or sudden deaths because of illnesses that couldn't be treated. Or, but because our medical technologies are getting better, people are living longer. But that also means that the last maybe 10, 15, 20 years of our life are lived in a condition in which we might need to rely on other people for support, right? So whether that's aged care, care for dementia or Alzheimer's, experiences of life that require a little bit more support from a welfare state. And so how we die is changing at the same time as we're going to have more people dying. So you've got this kind of peak death, people dying, but also 10, 20 years before that, they've also needed a lot more support around end of life and aging care. So it's a kind of different transformation of, as it were, of how Australians die and therefore what our systems of aged care and death care need to be in order to respond to that.
This seems like the right moment to talk about robots.
It is the right moment to talk about robots.
When is not the right moment to talk about robots?
I love
is
a good
what
robot.
I want to know.
As a friend of mine would say, get to the f***ing robots.
Get to the effing robots.
Beautiful. So, yeah, let's talk about robots.
Let's talk about robots.
How all good conversations start. I mean, this issue of peak death and decades of care and the need and the dependency of the aging population, those all do point to pressures on the welfare state and also direct our attention to innovation. And Japan is a place that you might say is leading the world in the use of robots in death care. Why is that?
So Japan, as I said, is far more along the line, as it were, in this kind of aging population, aging society. And they also have a kind of difficulty of a really low birth rate, low fertility. And what that means is basically they don't necessarily have enough young people of a working age who want to, but also have been employed to care for elderly people, right? So you have a real challenge, this massive challenge around finding enough aged care workers. And one of the ways that countries solve this problem around the world is through migration. So we often see in Australia, for example, we have a lot of, you know, nursing care, aged care from recent migrants to the country. Mm-hmm. And certainly Japan has pursued that to a certain extent. But because the Japanese cultural framework and I suppose government policies has also been to be very strict on migration, you don't have a lot of external migration, certainly not to the extent that we have in Australia, for example. One of the other pushes has been to use robotics or use robot systems in aged care and death care. So, you know, if we can't find the workers, maybe the robots will help us to care for our elderly.
Mm-hmm.
It has had mixed success.
Yeah.
I can talk you through some of the robots.
Talk about the robotics, the robot assistants. What do they look like? Are we talking kind of a Blade Runner or is it more like R2-D2?
Oh, definitely more R2-D2. So I think there's two categories broadly of robots that are used in this kind of arena. And I will direct everyone's attention as well as a follow-up to an extraordinary ethnography that's just been published called Robots Won't Save Japan by James Adrian Wright.
Also my new band name.
It's an excellent band name, I will say. But so he discusses there being kind of different types of robots. So you have physical robots that are there actually to assist people in moving the elderly. So, you know, similarly to we have kind of lifts and hoists that are used in healthcare, you know, in aged care, getting people out of bed, getting them dressed, those kind of physical tasks that require manual labour, right, are one kind of school, I suppose, or one kind of type of robots that have been trialled in these areas. The other kind of, and I would say more interesting in some ways, robots are social robots, social or emotional robots. These are cute and fluffy, or they have big eyes and cute faces and little names and very kind of drawing on that anime character tradition, WALL-E, the WALL-E tradition. Yeah. And they are more focused on solving issues of loneliness or distress or boredom, frankly, in aged care institutions. There's a very famous robot called Puddle, who is a seal, and he's a little furry white seal that you can hug and he will, you know, flap his tail and flap his flippers and nestle into you. I mean, you could just get a cat, I suppose.
Doesn't need to be fed, probably.
He does need to be charged.
Mm-hmm.
Often what we find actually is that these robots end up creating work in many situations. You know, you have to bring the manual care robot into the room and set them up and line them up correctly with the person you're trying to lift. And that can actually create a lot of labour around caring, not just for the person, but then also caring for the robot. And similarly, these kind of social robots are the ones you might have seen, like Pepper, the robot, who is a robot from SoftBank, who's a social robot. They're supposed to have a personality and be able to interact with you and give you advice and all these kind of things. I mean, they have been used in things like exercise classes or singing songs or entertainment kind of arenas. But they also, you know, require to be set up and cared for and charged the batteries of and all these kind of things. So both of those kind of, I suppose, two types of robots, the physical manual labour robot and the social emotional robots, have been trialled, but they have found mixed success, I would say.
In popular culture, Westerners tend to see Japan as a heady mix of time-honoured tradition and eccentric futurism. But what can we learn from the way in which Japan has embraced innovation in death care?
I think most Japanese people have a very different relationship to robots than Australians. They're far more familiar seeing them kind of advanced robotic machines, not only in their homes, but in their workplaces. And there's a different kind of cultural imaginary around them through popular media that will probably endear people to robots a little bit more. But at the same time, I think it is perhaps more existentially an interesting question of why we have delegated care for our elderly and dying and dead to robots as opposed to humans, and what maybe that says about us, Japan or Australia, frankly, about who we care for and who has to do the caring labour.
So do you think we should embrace robot death care in Australia, or should we instead find ways to improve care by humans?
Yeah, I don't think that robots are incapable of providing care. I think the kind of human, non-human divide is so often challenged in so many ways. And I think always when I think about this, I think of the number of people who choose to die at home predominantly so they can be with their dogs or their cats, right? So I think animals and non-humans, whether that be material culture, like, you know, having your bed, your bedroom, your, you know, your objects around you on one end of the scale, or is it, you know, robotics on the other end of the scale, are really important and can help people craft meaningful deaths. I think when it comes to the question of labour, though, I worry that in asking robots to do this care, we devalue the human workers who work in this space and the kind of extraordinary care they provide and our real strong moral responsibility to care for them also.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think in all of this, though, I just wanted to bring up the history of medical sciences, the sciences in general, have been towards like creating longer lives, making us live longer. We all want to live longer. And anyone who has experienced someone, as you touched on before, with dementia, with long-term terminal illness, with, you know, a slow dying, will tell you that it's not quantity. It's not, I don't want to live till 80 if from 60 to 80 my quality of life is terrible. Mm. And I guess I just wanted to gauge your thoughts on that.
Yeah, 100%. And it's fascinating because I think anyone who has cared for somebody with these kind of, let's call it prolonged dwindling cases, will know that what is death and what is the death of the person and what is the death of the body or the personality can all happen at very different times. Mm-hmm. When my father died, predominant emotion that we all felt was relief.
Yeah.
Because like he had been in palliative care for quite a long time. Like we knew it was going to happen and we were sad and we were grieving. But also it was like if you have these kind of timelines of people who perhaps have Alzheimer's or dementia for many years and have lost part of their personality or part of their relationship to people, that makes the kind of line around where is life and where is death very challenging. Something about death and technology that's really interesting is that death and technology intersect in really different ways. It's almost on two axes. You've got death positive or death denial, right? You've got people who are using technology to try and build better deaths and end of life experiences for people. And then you've got people who are using technology to try and deny death or fight death or beat death, which is what we call techno-salvationism. Like technology will save us. And of all the things it can save us from, death is like the greatest challenge, right? So if we only invent the best medicine, if we only invent the best robots, then we can beat death. And that certainly is a strain of death tech. But it doesn't take a genius to tell you that the majority of people, if death ever is defeated, are not going to be able to access it, right? And that in the meantime, we could have been using technology to actually help people die better.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I mean, there is certainly a cultural fascination with immortality or beating death. Can you tell us what kind of real world digital services are out there that are helping us maintain some kind of digital life beyond our physical and spiritual one?
Yeah. So when it comes to kind of life extension technologies, or I suppose these kind of immortality technologies, as we might say. I mean, there's a whole area that looks at the kind of immortality of the body. So cryonics, classic kind of, you know, that kind of area. How can we preserve the biology? There's a different school of thought, or I suppose different area of attention that looks at trying to preserve the personality or personhood or consciousness or whatever you might call it of the individual who's died, often through the use of AI, through chatbots in particular. So there's been many attempts to say if we can feed a kind of AI system, a chat GPT-like system, enough data from the person when they were alive, so enough voice recordings, enough kind of details about their life, about their personality, about their likes, their dislikes, then would it be possible to create a reasonable facsimile of them after they'd gone? So that could be in the form of, you know, a Twitter account that tweets for you after you've died, or a chatbot where you could get your, say, great-great-grandchildren to log on and have a conversation with their ancestor, for example. And you can certainly see the power of it in these kind of educational settings, right? Yeah. There's and this is all done obviously with the permission of the people who are giving news voices, and they've signed up for it and they've said, yes, I want to be part of telling this story. I think it becomes more challenging when we think about, you know, questions of who has the right to control your afterlife or your legacy after you've died. And what happens if, you know, it damages or diminishes your legacy in some way? It's a complicated thing. I think it's right that we don't dismiss it wholesale and kind of think it's all scary and Black Mirror, but it does provoke questions about ethics, right?
Well, that's right. I mean, I'm thinking of Microsoft's AI bot, Tay, who I think it took Twitter 24 hours to corrupt into a potty-mouthed racist.
Seems slow, frankly.
Hannah explained that how we manage someone's legacy after they die has always raised ethical questions.
You know, the dead are always kind of used and abused by the living in various different ways. You know, these legacies are always reinvented and changed and remixed in certain ways. But I think there's something about the immediacy of AI, the potential for it to be in someone's voice, in someone's image, that changes the impact a little more for us.
With respect to these burgeoning services that might capture our personality or our consciousness, is it still too early to judge whether anyone's going to care about these in a decade? Because the rate of change and technological obsolescence is so fast that how can we know that creating a bot today is not going to be, you know, in the annals of someone's broken, boxed computer in 10 years' time?
I think this is a really fascinating point because it brings up this whole idea of the actual life and afterlife of technologies themselves, right? And we invest in these new necro technologies, these new death tech systems, and sometimes can become extremely invested in them, you know, giving thousands of hours of content and emotions and stories to them, only for them to go defunct. And there's been a number of cases of particularly memorial websites where people might upload an extraordinary amount of information about their loved one that have been, again, venture capital backed websites, organizations that promised eternity. I mean, one of them was literally called Eternamy, very famous case. It promised to maintain the likeness, the memories of your deceased loved one forever. And it went broke, you know, and so that data was lost.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that can lead to all these ideas of it's almost, you know, like a second death in a way, right? You've given someone the promise of eternal memory and then you've lost that.
Hang on, right? Isn't it in the cloud? Mummy went
I mean,
to the cloud.
Everything is
in the cloud.
But the dead are in the cloud.
The cloud.
Someone, but I mean, it, you know, and again, like, you know, it could just be a matter of, you know, you have all of the recordings of your mum or dad on a VCR tape you know, and you no longer have a VCR player to see it.
I've been meaning to convert a couple of tapes for so long.
Exactly.
Haven't we all got a box of tapes that we should convert?
So VCR tapes degrade, or, you know, a record can be scratched, or a file can be lost in the cloud, right? So as soon as you decide to kind of invest the memory, the legacy of the deceased person into a particular technology, you then start to have to think about the actual life of that technology and how accessible it is and how its longevity, how long it can last and can it be passed down and that sort of thing. It's not all doom and gloom, but with all things, it is in a way the great thing about engaging with technology is it provokes these deeper questions about death and dying that can be a way into these conversations that people sometimes don't want to have otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I understand that during your time in Japan, you may have attended some robot funerals. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I went to a funeral that was led by a robot, which was quite interesting. But what I actually went to was a series of funerals for robots. So, which, you know, we might think is completely extraordinary and bizarre, but is not so different, I think, from us, for example, having funerals for our pets, which is more and more common these days. So there's a series of robotic dogs called Aibor, which are, I mean, I think they're the cute little kind of flippy dog creatures that people kind of had, particularly in the 2000s, 2010s, and people became very attached to. And as technology moved on, again, as the death tech itself died, more and more eyeballs started losing their parts, and they couldn't get replacement parts, and Sony no longer made replacement parts for them. They died, in a sense. They couldn't be used or interacted with anymore. And so a Buddhist temple decided to hold a large funeral for them. And this, I think, kind of builds into a broader legacy in Japan of what has been called funerals for objects, but might be perhaps better translated as like a memorial service or a service of gratitude in thanks for different objects, different materials that have served someone well. It particularly comes from a tradition of trades. So there's funerals for needles by tattoo artists and also seamstresses. So old needles that are too blunt to be used anymore are gathered up and given thanks to. I've seen funerals for tea whisks, funerals for scissors. Hairdressers often have funerals for scissors. There's certainly funerals for old eyeglasses by people who want to say thanks for these kind of technologies, for helping them through life. You know, and some of this you think, oh, you know, and I really don't want to feed into that, you know, oh, wacky Japan stereotype that I think is really easy and obvious. But, you know, we think about in Australia, you know, people's pets or teddy bears or, you know, soft toys you had as a kid, you know, all of these things that you form extreme intimate, you know, attachments to.
I have written before about the attachment to objects of the dead in a different, not burying the objects themselves,
but,
you know, the importance we place on inanimate objects.
Well, you said inanimate. But I guess the thing I'm wondering about these robot dogs, Eyeball, did you call them?
Eyeball, yeah.
Do the families, the bereaved, treat them as inanimate, or is it actually the opposite?
No, I mean, I think as an anthropologist, you realise that there are very few, if any, binaries in life. And animacy is certainly one of them. It's definitely a continuum. And there is certainly a Buddhist or animist tradition in Japan of seeing the material world as enlivened or animated in a way that perhaps we don't usually see in the West, in Australia. So you have far more of these circumstances of objects becoming enlivened. And in fact, there's also historical stories of objects being unruly and becoming alive and running around the house and that kind of background in popular culture. So I think certainly for people who are engaging in this act of mourning for their robot dogs, no, not at all. I mean, some of them saw them as part of the family. And why wouldn't you mourn the death of someone in your family, whether they be a robot dog or a real dog or a human? It's not so much, I think, about their category as it is about the relationship that you have with them.
Why is it important to set limits on what and who we grieve in ritual ways?
I think the thread running throughout our conversation today is kind of this notion of what we call personhood in anthropology. So anthropologists don't usually like to talk about like individuals or humans or animates, because there's so many examples of phenomenon that cross those boundaries. But we instead kind of tend to talk about persons or moral persons. So, you know, persons are recognised within our social system as having moral obligations towards them and generating moral obligations. That could be a dog, that could be your cat, that could be a human person, that could be an object in a church that's spiritual, that's important. You know, there's all these different things that could fall into the category of person. And then the other end of that, there are certain individuals in our society who are not recognised for their personhood, you know, that are incarcerated, or that, for example, we diminish the personhood of because of their experiences with Alzheimer's and dementia, right? We talk about a kind of a social death.
Yeah.
Or, you know, classically the example of this is, you know, enemies of the state, you know, outsiders, foreigners who we don't think we have to treat as persons and therefore have often been these kind of historically horrific cases of the treating of their bodies and not giving them funerals and that sort of thing. You know, Abu Ghraib is the prime example of this. So, you know, who we therefore decide are persons in our moral universe in a way is linked to how we treat them in death. So, you know, moral persons are ones that deserve funerals in some ways. They are ones that are grievable, right? They are entities that we should grieve for and are allowed to grieve for and we recognise the grief of.
I mean, corporations have legal personality and they have obligations to us, and we're all pretty familiar with the ways in which that can play out socially. But we tend not to grieve, say, the death of Alta Vista, you know, or other now defunct search engines and forms of tech. But is that changing? I mean...
Yeah, I don't think corporations yet have reached moral personhood. I think that kind of definition of them as having legal personhood within the American legal system, at least, was kind of highly contested for this very reason, right? Like, a company is an individual legally, but you'd never hold the door open for a company, right? Like, there is a distinction here between what we recognize as a moral person and what the law might recognize as an entity. And it is fascinating to me that fundamentally so much of that is tied to how we react to the life and death of that.
Thinking about death tech certainly provokes deeper questions about death and dying. Hannah left us with some wise words.
I should be clear, I think because I'm a death stoic scholar, like, I'm not asking everyone to sit down every morning and ponder mortality. I certainly do not do that. But there's a great expression that Zenith Virago, who's an extraordinary death educator based in Byron Bay, once told me, and that she kind of just said, well, all I'm asking for is people to leave death a seat at the table. Right, you know, whenever you get a diagnosis, when something happens in your life, in your everyday, you know, there's a table set up for a dinner party with many different friends who you might invite. And one of those is death.
Absolutely.
It's a good death. So, Hannah, what's a good death to you?
What a good death is so not only idiosyncratic, but entrenched in people's culture and religious contexts, that trying to impose a single model is entirely against the ethos of what we should be doing in our death care work. For me, I think I want to have quality of life for as long as possible in terms of being able to do the things I love, whether that's running and spending time with friends and cooking. And then when I can't do those things, I'd be very happy to go. I'm definitely going to take up some drinking and hard drugs in the final years, because why not?
Absolutely.
But, you know, I don't really want to hang around for much longer than I can't have those things. And, you know, being an academic, when I lose my ability to read and, you know, express myself, then I'm kind of okay to go. And then all my friends and family should spend all of their money on good red wine and cheese.
Absolutely.
And that's the ceremony they should have.
Hannah, thanks so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for having this conversation.
So, Lev, my friend, what did you take from that?
Ooh, lots of things. But I think the big theme there was really whether we're comfortable with robots or other machines that might be sentient being involved in death care in some way, whether that's when we're dying or in the funeral planning process. That's really interesting to me. And I honestly, I don't know if I'm comfortable with it because I have no frame of reference for it.
Yeah, I'm definitely not comfortable with it yet. But I think there will be advances over time by the time I get to that stage.
Yes.
Where hopefully, if necessary, that won't be as scary.
So we'll be more like Japan and we'll just be comfortable with these things because they'll be more like integrated into our daily life.
Yeah, we'll have to be probably.
So thanks again to Dr. Hannah Gould. In our next episode, we speak to a former child refugee about trauma, ancestral grief, and finding laughter in unusual places.
People think of grief as crying and letting go and getting over it. But grief is actually how we remember. It's how we continue a relationship with ourselves, with an identity, with a culture. It's how we continue a relationship with people who aren't physically here anymore. It's how we continue a relationship with life-altering, life-shattering experiences.
If this episode has raised issues for you and you'd like to seek mental health support, you can contact Beyond Blue on 1300 224636, or visit beyondblue.org.au. Also, Embrace Multicultural Mental Health supports people from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds. Visit embracementalhealth.org.au.
For 24/7 crisis support, call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Or in an emergency, please call 000.
Grave Matters is an SBS podcast written and hosted by me, Anthony Levin, and Nadine J. Cohen. Produced by Jeremy Wilmot. The SBS team is Carolyn Gates, Joel Supple, and Max Gosford. If you'd like to get in touch, email audio@sbs.com.au. Follow and review us wherever you find this podcast.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.